Hello, Robin here. A healthy body and a healthy weight are part of the same story, and every body has its own story to live. Gary Taubes, an exceptional author and science and health journalist, has written The Case for Keto. And even though some of this research goes back many years, only now is this cutting edge finding its rightful place at the front lines of healthcare. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Gary, in 2002, you wrote a New York Times Magazine cover story about the paradox presented by ketogenic eating, and your book, The Case for Keto, was out in 2020. What further inspired you? Was it that so much changed from 2002?
Well, this is, let's see, my fourth book. The New York Times Magazine article in 2002 gave me the luxury of getting to do 5 years of research and writing my first book on the subject, which was Good Calories, Bad Calories. And that came out in 2007 and helped catalyze this revolution where physicians around the country started thinking, rather than give the same useless advice they've been giving for decades to their patients who suffer from obesity, maybe they should assume that their advice was wrong and that they should do something different. So the past decade has seen this dramatic increase in the number of physicians around the world who are now prescribing these low-carbohydrate, high-fat, ketogenic diets. And what I kind of wanted to do with this latest book is reestablish why this is important and why anyone would consider cutting out an entire food group from their eating. I interviewed the 120 plus of these physicians, again, from the U.S. and Canada and Europe and Asia. And I wanted to learn what they had learned treating patients over the years. So that was kind of the logic behind this latest book. And I also wanted to write a book that skeptics would read. I'm not really speaking to the converted. I want anyone, any physician confronted with a patient with obesity who's not losing weight with their advice and wants to try something new to think, maybe I should read this book, The Case for Keto, and see why other physicians have bought into this. So it's written for individuals, but also for their doctors.
Yes. Now, can we start by putting it out there that the days of confusing keto or a keto diet with the severe diabetic condition of ketoacidosis are waning?
They're definitely waning. I'm not entirely sure they're over. The amount of ignorance in the medical and nutrition communities about sort of basic physiology is stunning. That was one of my learning experiences. So I got into this. The reason I wrote that New York Times Magazine story is that I'm an investigative science reporter with a hard science background. My first two books had been about physics. And when I got into nutrition, I was just stunned at not just what physicians believed might be true about the link between diet and disease, but what nutritionists believe based on no awareness of the history of their field. Yeah, diabetic ketoacidosis is a bad thing. You know, what happens in uncontrolled type 1 diabetes mostly, when it's kind of metabolic hell is breaking out and the liver begins massively generating ketones and they're not cleared from the blood, you end up losing them in the urine, and pretty quickly is associated with coma and death. And this was the greatest fear physicians had with their patients with diabetes before the discovery of insulin, and then insulin kind of eradicated that. And then on the other hand, you've got this what's called nutritional ketosis, which is basically what your body is doing if you go 2 days without food. So if you don't eat for 2 days, your brain, which is normally running on glucose, has to find, which is from carbohydrates, has to find a different fuel source. So your liver takes the fat that you're now mobilizing and synthesizes these molecules called ketones out of it. It's a completely natural phenomenon. really the function of it and the purpose of it was understood and elucidated in the 1960s by a Harvard physiologist named George Cahill and his collaborators, and it's completely natural. And yet, as soon as doctors started talking about diets, you could mimic this fasting condition by merely feeding diets that don't have carbohydrates in them. One of the responses from the medical community was, oh my God, ketones, those are bad, and you're going to cause diabetic ketoacidosis, and you're not. It's not going to happen, but that doesn't stop people from repeating convenient myths if they...
Right, know. If they're inundated with them, yeah. Right? Yes. Now, yeah. I appreciated very much that you included something about being cautious with children regarding diet. And since you brought up human physiology already, you state there that basing a diet not on physics but on human physiology is a good way to go.
Well, and so this is the nub of what I've been getting to in my books and what I'm hammering on here. So for 90 years, the conventional wisdom has been that people get fat because they eat too much. There's a lot of technical terms, people for energy imbalance. And this is supposedly dictated by the laws of thermodynamics, which it's not, but that's what obesity researchers believe, that's what nutritionists believe, that's what the general prescriptions about how to lose weight, eat less and exercise more means consume less energy and expend more energy, and ergo you will lose weight. And yet it's sort of based on physics. So the idea is energy is neither created nor destroyed. This is the first law of thermodynamics, energy conservation. And physicists think the energy in a system gets bigger, then the mass gets bigger. And all of this is translated into this crazy idea that people just get fat because they eat too much. If you look at the biology of fat accumulation, the physiology of fat accumulation, which was worked out between the 1930s and the 1960s, and was pretty well understood by the 1960s, the idea is that fat storage in the human body is dominated by the hormone insulin, which is also the hormone that's functional in diabetes, and there's a very tight association between both diabetes and obesity and the emaciation in type 1 diabetes that comes when you lack insulin. But anyway, if you elevate insulin levels, you store calories as fat, and when you want to get fat out of your fat cells, you have to reduce insulin. That's the way it was described in the 60s, is the negative stimulus of insulin deficiency is necessary. So what a ketogenic diet is a diet that minimizes insulin secretion by removing the carbohydrate. So the general argument is if you have a child who suffers from obesity, and more children are suffering these days, you can try to get them to eat less and exercise more, in effect starve them and exhaust them and hope somehow that removes fat from the fat cell. Or you could just say physiologically, we have to lower this child's insulin, and the way we do that is to see if he or she is interested in not eating carbohydrates. And then you end up eventually with a ketogenic diet as a diet that minimizes insulin. So it's a difficult situation with children because basically this theory says that they can't tolerate eating the food their thin friends can. Thin friends can eat pasta and french fries and candy bars and remain thin, and they can't. And that's contrary to virtually all the sort of dietary prescriptions that have grown up around the energy balance idea, which is if you start telling kids they can't eat certain foods, you'll create eating disorders, which could be true. But this theory says that the fundamental cause of the obesity, the dietary cause, is a carbohydrate content to the diet, the starches and grains and sweets. And there's no avoiding that.
Right. And also, I believe that insulin is created if you eat constantly. If you don't take a break from eating, no matter what you're eating, it tends to create more insulin in the body. Is that true? Did you find that in your research?
I mean, yeah, it depends what you're eating. So you'll secrete insulin primarily in response to the carbohydrates in the diet. So insulin is secreted in response to this carbohydrate, glucose. One issue is that when you eat protein, the significant point of the protein is the amino acids in the protein are converted to glucose, and so that too will stimulate insulin secretion. Dietary fat, for the most part, will not. So, and again, this is when you're eating a ketogenic diet, fat constitutes the great bulk of the calories because it doesn't stimulate insulin secretion. Typically, when people eat all day long or consume calories all day long, so for instance, you have breakfast and then you drink a Coca-Cola or a coffee with sugar in it between breakfast and your snack, and then you have a snack, and then you drink coffee, and it goes on all day long. As long as you're consuming carbs, you're storing fat. If you're secreting insulin, and if your insulin levels are elevated, there's a condition that most people, or virtually all people with obesity, effectively have, which is called insulin resistance. So their cells become resistant to the insulin that their pancreas is secreting, and their pancreas responds by secreting more insulin. So now insulin stays elevated. One of the things insulin does is it locks fat up in the fat tissue, and it tells the rest of the body to burn carbohydrates, to burn glucose. So if the insulin's elevated but you're not eating, you don't have a source of glucose for your cells to burn, so your cells get hungry and you get hungry again. That's this sort of alternative theory of how this all works. But one way or the other, the way to fix it is to remove the carbohydrates from the diet, grains, starches, and sugars. Over the past 90 years, researchers have thought about obesity in terms of this idea that it's an energy balance problem, that people take in more calories than they expend. But if you think about when you're getting obese, what's getting obese in your body? Your fat cells are expanding with excess fat, and they're also becoming more numerous. So you're stimulating the creation of new fat cells from these sort of pre-fat cell precursors. And if you look at what makes a fat cell fat, the hormone insulin dominates. So what the fat cell sees is this insulin in the bloodstream, and the insulin is telling it to take up fat. It's floating around the bloodstream and to hold on to it, and it's telling it to inhibit the release of fat. What you want to do is get your fat cells to release the excess fat that they've stored. You want them to mobilize that so it gets into the bloodstream, and you want the rest of the body to burn that. And the way you do that is not to eat less and exercise more. The way you do that is to lower insulin. And often when I speak to researchers who have grown up with this idea that this is an energy balance problem, and I said, imagine creating a theory of obesity from the fat cell's point of view. The insulin's telling it to hold on to the fat. And if you want to get fat out, you've got to lower insulin. And it seems ridiculously simple. It's never been taken seriously for 50 years just because the people dominating obesity researchers were these thin people, to put it simply, who thought that people get fat because they eat too much. By the 1960s, obesity research is dominated by psychologists and psychiatrists trying to get people who suffer from obesity to eat less, not by physiologists or hormone specialists known as endocrinologists who might be saying to themselves, why is this person accumulating so much fat?
Right.
Clearly a hormonal problem. What yes. hormone do we have to fix?
I know you did turn into a history professor, so to speak. Anthropologically speaking, we have so many people around the world eating rice and beans and add a squash and you're south of the border. And I'm wondering how historically relevant is that? Is that only really recent history?
The key to doing good science is asking the right question. And I say this as a journalist who has studied good science and bad science for 40 years. The observation that we want to explain is we have obesity and diabetes epidemics worldwide. In effect, every population in the world, regardless of their traditional diet, will manifest this explosion in obesity and diabetes after they switch to a Western diet and lifestyle.
Right.
We've seen this happen over the past 150 years for the most part. And you can find it in the literature, as I did, from anthropologists studying Native American populations, first years of the 20th century, writing about obesity manifesting in those populations. And we have these epidemics. What's the agent the conventional wisdom is people just eat too much and they become sedentary. But what happens, the dramatic change in diet is the carbohydrates they consume become more refined. So instead of eating like brown rice, they eat white rice. And instead of living on, you know, beans and rice, they live on beans and rice and white flour. Then probably the biggest player is sugar. In my mind, my last book was called The Case Against Sugar.
Yes.
And since the mid-19th century, sugar consumption around the world just exploded. Expensive. It went from being something of a luxury to the cheapest of all calories. And obesity and diabetes basically follows sugar around the world, particularly sugary beverages. So with each generation, it gets worse and worse.
Right.
And eventually you get to the place we are today. 40% of the population is obese, and it's not enough anymore to just not eat sugar and white flour. Now they have to pretty much get rid of all the carbs. And it can be reversed in most people, but it takes a lot of effort.
You talk about slow carbs and fast carbs. Talk about them for us.
So slow carbs are minimally refined carbohydrates. Carbohydrate-rich food. They have a lot of fiber in them, and the fiber slows down digestion and absorption. So it takes the carbohydrates in the food longer to get into the bloodstream, and the longer it takes, the more gradual the insulin secretion and responses. So these foods are relatively healthy. Fast carbs are the highly refined carbs, white flour and sugar being the two extremes.
Right.
And these hit the body very quickly, and we never evolved to deal with. And vegetable oils may play some role here, too. So the idea is if you're lean and healthy and young and you want to stay lean and healthy, you could probably be fine just eating whole foods, slow carbs, staying away from processed, highly refined carbs, sugar, and sugary beverages. But most people who read diet books aren't lean, healthy people in their teens or 20s. They're those of us who fatten easily and struggle with our weight and our blood sugar and our blood pressure. And for us, we need probably to avoid most or all carbs, slower, fast, or not.
Now, what would you say to someone who did the keto thing and were very successful in their 40s and then went off it a while, but then went back to it as they were approaching 60 and it did not work for them?
It's the kind of question I ask the physicians I interviewed. And you would say, well, let's send them to me and let's talk about it and see what we're dealing with.
Right.
Clearly, our bodies change as we age. I would want to know what they're eating and what they're not eating and whether or not it's the diet or the application of the diet. Maybe they're being impatient. Maybe it's working, but not as quickly as they did in their 40s or their 20s. You know, as we age, sex hormones also play a large role. So a significant part of the fat that's accumulated from the 40s onward is sex hormone related as much as diet related.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So there could be issues like that involved as well.
Gary, I'd love for you to share the Holacy's discovery for the athletes listening and why it's not such a good idea to drink a Gatorade after a good workout.
Yeah, it's funny. I used to do that. I'm a large,
so many
sweaty
people do that
individual, and yeah, I would spend an hour in the gym and 40 minutes on the Stairmaster or the treadmill or the ergometer and counting my calories. So I slowly got up to 400 or 500 calories, and then I would go outside and buy a 32-ounce Gatorade, it's at these big bottles, and drink it in like 30 seconds. And think, oh, that's interesting. I just replaced 3/4 of the calories I burnt, and it took me 45 minutes to burn them and 30 seconds to replace them. The idea is, in effect, again, when you're consuming carbohydrates, you're secreting insulin and you're storing fat. So the exercise will make you relatively insulin sensitive, which means when you do lengthy, especially endurance exercise, aerobic exercises, you get to a point where you're burning the carbohydrates that are stored in the form of glycogen. And so after you're done with the exercise, your body wants to replete the glycogen, and it makes it easy to do. You don't need a lot of insulin for this, so you can store carbohydrates very quickly post-exercise. But while you're doing that, if you're consuming something like Gatorade, the insulin secreted in response to the glucose, who's going to tell your fat cells to hold on to fat and to try and replenish the fat that you also might have burned during the exercise. So again, one of the messages of this book is lean people are just wired differently. Lean people, their bodies don't want to store fat. They want to burn the calories as energy. And those of us who fatten easily, we have bodies that want to store fat. So we have to think in those terms. We can't eat what the thin people eat. Lean people eat. We can't drink what the lean people drink, because what's fine for them doesn't work for us. You know, when you become an athlete, I think that carbohydrates are great, and it almost is a sort of performance enhancer to allow you to, you know, exercise at a greater intensity or compete at a greater intensity for maybe a longer period of time. But if the goal is to achieve a healthy weight and maintain it, then these are not foods or drinks you can consume.
Right. So what do you drink now? Consume. Maybe water with a little bit of sea salt in there or something?
I use these electrolyte mixtures personally because I'm still a large, sweaty individual. So, yeah, I drink water with the electrolyte. I don't even really like it sweetened, because then it tends to make me like everything sweetened.
Right.
The problem, as soon as you start consuming carbohydrate, a sugar-rich beverage, your body's going to start secreting insulin, and your fat tissue is going to hold on to the fat that's in there and do its best to replenish that fat. If you exercise to get lean, then as soon as you have that Gatorade afterwards, the process is being reversed.
All right. Now, I personally cringe when I hear that something anecdotal is held as lesser than, insinuating double blind is the only way to go, or only the lab proven tests are the way to go. Knowing what you know and learning from so many different directions, do you have a comment about that?
Yeah, the process of science begins with observations. So you see something, it might be in conflict to your expectations, so it presents a hypothesis, and then you could go on to test the hypothesis. But every observation is valuable. Good science is about not overinterpreting what you see. So, for instance, I have a friend, a young man, who, when he was 18 years old, weighed 400 pounds and decided to do a ketogenic diet, and his father would go to Costco and buy him 30 pounds of ground meat a week, and he would eat this, and he lost 130 pounds in 4 months, basically eating fatty ground meat and green vegetables, and he'd never been able to lose weight before in his life. He'd always been obese. So this is a remarkable phenomenon. Does it mean the same thing will happen to me? No. Right. Or anyone else, because that's overinterpreting it. But you see something like that, you think, maybe it would happen to me. So now I have a reason to test that hypothesis on myself, and without randomized controlled trials.
Right.
And this is the point. You can test it yourself. You don't need a clinical trial to see if a ketogenic diet will work for you. You can test it. The reason I wrote this book is so you could say, well, this is really interesting. I can try this myself.
Right.
What we know because of the clinical trials is it's not dangerous. It's not going to increase your risk of heart disease. All that saturated fat is not going to clog your arteries and kill you immediately. You can do it yourself and see what happens.
Right.
I'll try all sorts of seemingly odd.
You're in good company.
I don't want to use the word quackish, but seemingly odd interventions. I have tinnitus, for instance, the ear ringing. Awful. Somebody tells me they tried something and their tinnitus got better, I'm likely to try it too, almost regardless of what it is, because I would like to be able to live without tinnitus.
Right.
I'm aware that when I'm trying it, it may have unfortunate negative side effects. So if I find something that does work, I'm hoping I'm not making my life quieter, but shortening it considerably at the same time.
Yes.
You know, that's what that anecdote doesn't tell me. It says this might help. It doesn't tell me what the side effects or the complications of it will be if it does help.
Right. But you know what? I find that those anecdotal things are the things that aren't worth researching, because they're not going to bring forth a big income for some company. So I feel pretty safe with a lot of anecdotal things. And plus, they're oftentimes time-tested just from the fact that somebody's grandmother's grandmother did this.
Yeah, I agree with you. I worry about some of the things I try, some Chinese herbs that a friend recommends, and hey, lo and behold, my tinnitus seems to get better for a month, and then it starts to get worse again, and then I'm wondering, well, now what happens if I go off the Chinese herb? did I do long-term damage? You don't know.
Right, yeah.
I'm a big fan of self-experimentation, and I try to discuss this in the book. Originally, this book was called How to Think About How to Eat. Because you shift your perspective on how your body works from this energy balance problem to this idea that fat accumulation is a hormonal regulatory problem, and then you experiment with different ways to readjust or re-regulate the hormones that are disordered and causing the fat accumulation. But you have to be aware of the potential downsides as well.
Yeah, well, just like there are no silver bullets, there are no guarantees either, you know, and we can't expect someone else to be responsible for our own health. We can get good advice and we can see people about it, but ultimately it's our gig, you know, we've got to take responsibility.
It's funny because today I got an email from a reader who was asking a question about an insulin-sensitizing drug named metformin that she's been on for years. And then she said at the end of the email, I realize you're not a doctor and can't give advice here, but my doctor clearly can't give good advice either.
You've written so many books, and The Case for Keto is your last book. Do you have another book in the works?
I do. I'm working on a book on the diet diabetes story. Diabetes is a very interesting example because until insulin was discovered in 1921, diabetes was seen as sort of a carbohydrate intolerance disorder. You need insulin to metabolize the carbohydrates. So without insulin or with too much insulin, you can't properly deal with the carbohydrates in the diet. Medical consensus was that people who suffered from diabetes should eat, they called animal diets back then, which was fatty animal meat and green leafy vegetables. Mm. And then insulin is discovered, and it's a lifesaver for people with what we now think of as type 1 diabetes. But they're giving insulin to everyone, and once you start giving insulin, you have to make them eat carbohydrates so they can metabolize it.
The Case for Keto with Gary Taubes. For any info on what we do here, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. We podcast on the usual platforms, and we welcome your likes and comments. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.